Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show. Hey, all you avid listeners out there, this is Dr. John, and if you enjoy what you're hearing on these joint podcasts with me and my fiancée, Jory Rose, please know that we are offering a week-long retreat in Costa Rica in April of 2023 at one of the top resorts in the country where the body workers are next level, and you will learn from myself and Jory how to be in better relationship to yourself, to your loved one, and to everyone else. This is going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Please feel free to check out the podcast notes for more links, details, and info. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Hey, everybody, this is Dr. John Shin with the Evolved Caveman Podcast, and I am back with another episode, and I am really excited to have with me today Jason Gerardo with One Path Coaching. And I met Jason at a Dan Millman retreat in Costa Rica. So we have kept in touch since then. And a little bit about Jason. Jason's healing path started from a very early age. His paternal great-grandmother was an Apache medicine woman, and throughout early childhood, he was told to look after her. And the message he received from that was, I need to help others in life. After high school, he went into the Marine Corps, traveled the world. He was able to live in Japan for extended periods, allowing him to explore Zen, meditation, and mindfulness techniques. And it took until 1999 for Jason to rediscover his healing gifts when he picked up neuro-linguistic programming, a subject about which I am quite interested. In 2010, he was certified as a practitioner, and in 2015, he was certified as master practitioner. Jason, welcome. How are you doing?
Thanks. Welcome. Thanks for having me, John. I'm doing well. It's a great morning, and I'm glad to be here with you.
Yeah, nice and brisk out there. How's the weather where you're at?
Well, in California, you know, for us, it's cold. It's probably about 40 degrees, but some other people would deny that.
It's very cold. Although I've got my fiance's daughter's in Wisconsin right now, and I imagine it's a little colder there.
Yes, I did some cold weather training out there when I was in the Marine Corps, and we lived outside, and it was a little chilly. Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Okay.
Out there, yeah.
On the lake?
No, up in the hills. They take us out in the boonies. Let us go out there and get some training and one small room to warm up in, but you live outside for that whole week.
Ooh, sounds like fun.
Definitely.
So let's dive into NLP or neuro-linguistic programming. What is neuro-linguistic programming?
So kind of the phrase that I use to explain it, the shortcut is using the language of the mind to get the results that you desire. A little more technical of it, a little bit of the background and history of it. So it was from the 1970s, UC Santa Cruz. There was a professor and a student that got together that both had similar interests. And that was John Grinder was the professor, and then Richard Bandler was a student. And, you know, they were just really looking at effective ways of therapy and how to get results. It was very results-driven, was the mindset. And Richard was doing work with Fritz Perls at the time, and John was doing things with computers and language, and Gregory Bateson, which was at Santa Cruz at the time, I believe, was also as well. But basically what NLP did is there's a process called modeling. And modeling is really, you know, you model for excellence. So you find someone that does something really well, and then you model it. And you take, okay, they do these 97 things, and then you cut off the idiosyncratic stuff. You know, what do you not need to do? What's, you know, a golf, if you're doing modeling of a golf swing, you know, if a certain golf player, if Tiger Woods adjusts his belt before he takes a swing, do you need to adjust your belt before you take a swing? You know, looking at things like that, and then you cut it down to, okay, here's the seven things that everyone that does great golf swing does. So they use the modeling process. They modeled Milton Erickson for hypnosis, Gregory Bateson, for a language and communication model, Virginia Satir for family therapy model. And like I said, that they both actually worked with Virginia, and Fritz Perls for Gestalt therapy. Gestalt therapy is kind of focusing on the present moment, not using the past, which we talk about as filters in NLP. So that's kind of where it came from. the technical of it, the gist of it is that, so we have a lot of information coming at us all times. Millions, hundreds of millions of bits of what we call bits of information, right? So your unconscious mind can process, the last studies I saw said about 50 million bits of information.
Per second.
Per second. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And the conscious mind can process about 50. So you can imagine what information is coming at us and how we're processing that information on a cognizant level, but also then what's our unconscious mind seeing. So you have an external event and that comes at us with what we call modalities, not to get too technical, but basically your sight, your sound, you see something, you hear something, you get a feeling.
Your senses, yeah.
Your senses, exactly. And then it comes through the filters. And our filters are like language, memories, decisions, what we call metaprograms, which are just filters, internal filters, values, beliefs, and attitudes. So they go through all the, that process, that external event goes through those filters. And then you have an internal representation, which gives you a state, how you feel, changes your physiology, and then that turns into your behavior. Somewhere in all of that, if it doesn't all align with what your goal is, you're not going to achieve that goal. So neurolinguistics is really looking at all of those things and seeing how, looking at your values, your strategies, and adjusting them to get to live the life you desire, truly.
So give me an example of where your thoughts, beliefs, filters are not aligning with your goal.
Just a basic one, you know, working with a lot of people in, you know, NLP, we work with education and business and then therapy. That's kind of the three forms that it goes through. Business is one of the main ones. Think about somebody that, you know, back in the day, and people still do make phone calls for business. Okay. So say you have to make phone calls and reach out to people, to get sales, and sales is your goal, right? So, but what if there's something in your filters that say you shouldn't make phone calls? Or what if your process, as you think about making phone calls to a possible client, somewhere in there, what if you have a picture of the client saying no or being angry or not liking what you have to say? So as you go through your strategy of making that call, there's something in that strategy that's faulty. So you're going to run through your strategy. You're going to pick up your phone. You're going to dial the number. You're going to get the person on the phone. And then you're going to get that. Let's say your strategy is down. You get that picture of someone saying no. And you react to it. And you don't have your confidence. And so then you don't accomplish that goal because the person on the line is like, no, I don't want to buy from you. Just as an example mm-hmm. Of how that would work.
No, I appreciate the example because I need something simple for my mind to make sense. So that's helpful. Right. Thank you. Yeah. And so what would NLP do in that situation? Because the other roadblock I see there is sensitivity to rejection as a personality trait.
Right. And so that's where it gets into, you know, every person is different. Every situation is different. And so if I was seeing this person as a client, and I have had clients similar to this, what we would do in the beginning is we want to get rid of all the negative emotions from the past and any limiting decisions from the past. And so that sensitivity to rejection is most likely a limiting decision from their past. Somewhere in their past through their developmental stages, there's a very good chance that something they heard, something they saw, something they felt led them to believe that rejection, that they might get rejected, and that and or rejection is a bad thing. So hopefully we cleared most of that up in the early work. And then when we get to this exact situation, so what we would do is there's a really fun exercise that you scramble the strategy, basically, because, you know, the strategy being I do step one, I do step two, I do step three, I do step four. So let's say step three is the problem. So we would go in with a process and we would scramble that. And let's say we would get rid of that step three so that you can't go from two and keep going on. So we would get rid of that current strategy that you have. The process, and I don't know how deep we want to go with that, but the process is basically what happens is you have submodalities behind that. And submodalities are, so we already said modalities are like our senses, right? Mm-hmm. Submodalities are the distinctions within those. So a submodality of visual would be the brightness of the picture. The color, is it in color or black and white? Is it moving or still? Is it focused or not, et cetera? There's some things that we look at. So what we would do is we would destroy those submodalities, because the submodalities are how we imprint things in our mind. So as just kind of going sideways for a second, if you think of something you really like and you think about, when you think about this, do you have a picture? And most people would. And it's something you like, that picture is most likely going to be bright, in color, close to you, very clear. If you think of something you don't like, it's most likely going to be darker, maybe black and white, a little bit fuzzy, and farther away from you. And that's just how we code. That's what neurolinguistic looks at, is that coding and how we code these pictures in our minds. So what we do is, if in the example I've given, that person that has a picture maybe of somebody rejecting them and saying no, I could almost guarantee that that picture is going to be bright, right in front of them, have a lot of energy and a lot of power. So what we do is we take the energy off of that picture and we scramble it. So we run them through the strategy. At each point of their strategy, we desensitize them, so to speak, of that modality. So the first thing I do is I see the phone. Oh, when you see the phone, do you get a warm feeling and think, man, this is going to be a great call? And maybe the person would say, no. And then you say to them, well, could it be and still work? So now what you're doing is you're installing, because now they have to try that on. They have to say, when they look at that phone and have that picture, they're like, well, what if it felt nice when I saw that? Oh, well, no, that wouldn't work. But they've tried it on now. So you've already started to interrupt that pattern because you've changed something in it. And then you go through the whole thing and you do that and you just scramble that whole strategy. And so what happens is, and in NLP has a lot of humor behind it, because if you're laughing, you're learning.
I love
so
that.
So you like to have a lot of, you like to have fun with it and you just get silly. You know, it's like, oh, and I hear someone's voice and you're like, oh, is that voice sound like, you know, Donald Duck? And you might do a silly voice and
yeah.
The person's like, well, no. But now you have them laughing and now you have them out of that picture.
Let me go to a different modality then, and just sure. Let's look at hearing, for example. And I remember, so I'm going to share a really dark story that I do not share with many people because it is pretty dark. But I remember I was doing the radio show in Richmond, which at the time was, I think, top two in the country for homicides per capita. And I was interviewing a police detective from the Richmond PD who had done every possible position in Richmond PD, from SWAT to homicide to beat to everything. And after the interview, he spent like an hour kind of unloading, because I think he was almost compelled to. He had no one else to talk to, kind of in my mind. And one of the stories he told me has always stayed with me. There's a couple stories, actually, but I'll just share one that revolves around the sense of hearing. And he said, you know, it's not always what you see on the job. Sometimes it's what you smell or what you hear. And he said there was one time when a father had gotten into the car in the driveway and backed the car out of the driveway and ran over a toddler in the driveway. And when we got to the scene, the mother was screaming in anguish and in grief over her deceased child. And he said, I just can't get that scream out of my head. So what might you do in that situation?
There's a couple different things there going on. And, you know, the one thing is that early on, NLP was called out for not being humanistic, because it was all about getting results and about that, you know, just do the technique and get the results. It has since grown to be more humanistic. And, you know, but NLP would look at that structurally. So what's the structure of that problem? Now, and without talking to the person and not knowing the person and having rapport with him to kind of see what's going to work with him, the first thing I would think of is that memory in general is almost like a phobia. And a phobia is a one-time learning for the most part. So he has a lot of things tied to that one memory, so to speak. Okay. So I would consider doing what's called the fast phobia model, and it's a disassociation process. So disassociate him from that memory because he remembers being there. And so you, what you kind of do is you put that memory up on a movie screen. And this is just a very small version of mm-hmm. it. You put a movie of that memory up on the movie screen, and then you put him in the theater watching that movie screen. And then you put another version of him up in the projection booth, watching him watching that movie. You run that movie all the way forward, and then you stop it, and then you run it, and then making sure he knows he's safe, and then run it all the way backwards in color fast. So he sees there is a before that event. And so it just, and that once again gets rid of that coding, but it puts them disassociated. So they're at a safe place. So they're not so involved in it at that.
Yeah.
First.
I guess the phrase I would use for that is you're creating psychological distance.
Right.
Rather than you're not immersed in your self-talk or in the memory, you've got some distance between yourself and it. So like the one example I love of that was I was asking a client a while back to describe his anxiety. And he said, it feels like being in a hurricane. And I was like, wow, that's a great description. I love that, right? You can barely breathe. The oxygen's getting sucked out of the air. Stuff's flying around you really fast. Some of it's bouncing off of you and hurting you. And I said, well, so one of the things you can do there is just step into the eye of the hurricane. So you have a little bit of breathing room, a little bit of safety. And then after that, imagine yourself as the weatherman reporting on the hurricane from a safer distance, 2 miles away. And then you can go a step further to be the news anchor in the TV studio talking to the weatherman. So similar idea.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, we're coming at from different points of view, but it's the exact same thing. And like I said, the great thing about NLP, and you and I discussed this before as we talked, is that because you're very scientific, you know, and very much into, you know, your background is your background and mine is NLP, and NLP has taken from the things that you've studied and pulled things out of it. So we have the similarities in there as well. So that's exactly it. And, you know, I just want to say for the listeners, and sometimes I use jargon and obviously you know this, but associate is like when you're looking through your own eyes and you're feeling the feelings of being in a memory, and disassociate is when you see yourself in the picture. So you're not into there. So that's that.
Yeah. So it's sort of third person.
Exactly.
Step outside of yourself. Exactly. The other one I like is, you know, let's say you have some trauma of a parent yelling at you when you were a small child. And this really speaks to the 12-year-old in me, the bathroom humor German in me, where you can imagine their voice coming out of a different body part, like their ass, for example. Right. And to me, that makes it kind of comical and funny. Right. The other, do you ever overlay different music onto a memory to make it less problematic or less traumatic?
That is a technique that's used in NLP. I don't normally do that. I had a peer that I was actually working with, and she was saying, okay, now see that memory and now hear circus music over it.
Yeah.
So, and she was an NLP master practitioner as well. And so that is something that's layered in there. It's just something I don't normally use with clients.
Yeah. I just like the Benny Hill theme song,
right?
Putting that over, you know, something that's kind of difficult to remember. Yeah. But again, it's partly, how do you lighten it up? How do you change the emotional impact to the memory so that you can process it more objectively?
Exactly. And that's what I was saying. The first step on that particular client from Richmond would be, I would do that to really take the energy off of that memory, because that memory as a whole has a lot of juice. The auditory part is the one that he's calling out. And then we could go in there and do work on the auditory if needed to be. And honestly, with, like I said, without having rapport with him, without knowing that client, I don't know if I would go silly with it, because that's a very serious situation. I don't want to make light of it. Right. But what you could do is you could make him hear, like to your point, hear something else and not something silly, but maybe make something that's a little soothing, maybe hearing nature noises, because we all have that plugged into nature.
Well, and it's funny, because I've talked to so many fire and police over the past 25 years, and I guess special ops, that I have these stories bouncing around in my head from them that are slightly traumatic to me, and I wasn't even there.
Right.
And so it's fascinating how that works, just because I have great compassion and empathy for what they're doing. I have a lot of respect for the difficult jobs that they have.
Right.
So did NLP help you with your life?
For sure. Yeah. So something is that there's actually a book, and I've worked with the author of the book, just in, we were on the same panel, but it's called the User's Manual for the Mind, NLP. Okay. So NLP has a lot of great tools on how to live your life. And for me, what NLP did is it just really gave me an awareness of life, an awareness of issues. It allowed me to look at my values, to really connect with my unconscious mind and, you know, be aware of my unconscious mind and connect my unconscious mind. And it really brought my mindset to the forefront. You know, it was really something that allowed me to break it all down. You know, we live in emotion, we live in memory, and sometimes you just float in that, or you're in that hurricane, so to speak, right? And this allowed me to say, let me stop. Let me recognize it for what it is. Let me see what it is. Let me deal with things in their way. You know, something that came up, and, you know, you were talking about my background and my past and things of that nature. Something is that I wanted to mention is that I was a very emotional child. And for whatever reason, you know, talking about the evolved caveman, for whatever reason, at a young age, it was like not okay to show emotion. And so I ended up...
You're a guy.
Exactly. What are you talking
about? That's how we're taught.
You know, and I really, because of that, I really became hard, and I really got a hard shell. And it was really something that I just evolved, you know, where I was like, okay, so I can't show my emotion. So I'm going to be stoic and I'm not going to show emotion. And that was something that was a part of who I was. And with NLP, you know, just a quick story. When I went to my training for my first practitioner, you know, the great thing about going through a training is that you also get free therapy, so to speak, right? Yeah. So we were doing the process called timeline therapy. And timeline therapy, as I was talking about earlier, is a situation where you let go of the negative emotions from your past and your limiting decisions from your past. And you go through and you do anger and sadness and fear and, you know, guilt and stuff. There's five main ones, and then you could do whatever the client needs beyond that. Well, we got to sadness and I wouldn't do it. I was with my training partner and I said, I don't want to do this, because the fear of showing sadness. And I was like, I'm going to cry to myself, you know, that, and it hit me square in the face. Like, what is going on? You can't even process this, allow yourself to process this in this safe place. And that was a huge awakening for me.
And what was the rule there, do you think, in your training, your socialization process? Is it, I can't cry in front of others?
I think it's more simple than that, is you don't show emotion in front of others.
But anger, you're able to check sadness in the other emotions.
Because, well, that's a good point. Where the other ones, though, I was, because it was more acceptable, where I think sadness was the one that, and you're going to charge me for this session? No, yeah, I'm just definitely joking. No, that's a great point, is that, yeah, there was a rule about sadness, because I grew up around very strong women that weren't allowed to show. But then when they would have sadness, they'd be like, oh, would you stop crying? Oh, would you just stop it?
Yeah.
And, you know, that was my model. And so definitely sadness was a hot button for sure.
Well, and the reason I'm kind of harping on this is because I do think that there's a universality to what you're saying, that I think for most men, sadness is the most difficult emotion to show, share. I think we have a lot of embarrassment about it. I mean, if we're depressed, we have a lot of shame about it. And I think it's hard. So do me a favor, go through your emotional journey, because it always fascinates me to have, and I've talked to a number of these men that were deeply sensitive or felt things deeply, very emotional, like myself. Then we learn to shut it down and be stoic. And then you have this hard armor or shell on. And then you went into the Marines. And then you got out and then had to kind of unlearn the stoicism, I'm assuming.
Right. Yeah. And it was just that epiphany, you know, of it's okay. But yeah, definitely started off with that. You know, the one thing is that, so the two male figures that I had in my life was my maternal grandfather and old country, born in 1915, first generation born in the United States, Portuguese dairy farmers, you know. And he ended up opening his garage and had sold Oldsmobiles, was very successful, had his own business. But he went.
So he was probably really warm, soft, and cuddly.
Yeah. he was a grandpa was a great man, but you know, they had that generation had their own stuff as well. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And yeah, for sure. He was business, get it done. Well, you just do it and you just make it happen. I come home, I drink my little drinky drink, and then I eat some dinner and I sleep on the chair and that's it. I get up the next day and go to work. And so it was like, that was one example. And then my father was born in 1938, still with us, kicking butt, still at 84. But he grew up on a ranch. He was a rancher, you know, tough kid, eight children. Mom ruled with a heavy spoon, so to speak, Hispanic, you know, we're Native American and Mexican. And anyway, so he grew up tough, grew up on that, also went in the Marine Corps. But dad's always been somewhat of a poet too, he got me into literature. He showed me a lot about music. Exactly. You know, so there was always that example. It wasn't talked about though, because you didn't really talk about these things, but that was always there. There was always that glimmering light that I can be sensitive, but
yeah, you just don't show it there.
Exactly. But you still don't show it. You still don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So I went through my life and dealt with, you know, you figure out how to do it to a point, and not to go too far, but you know, something that came up in my life is that I'm very good at mimicking. I'm very good at taking someone's persona on.
Yeah, the social chameleon.
Yeah. Almost like an actor. And I was really good at it. And it came to a head for me in the Marine Corps. The military experience. Wow. You know, you go into a whole nother world and no one knows how to act and everyone's trying to figure out how to act. You know, you had someone on your show that listened to another podcast. I think he was in Army, maybe Special Forces, and his experience was very negative because he didn't know how to act and he really grabbed on to the wrong behavior.
Yeah.
And went really negative with it. But, you know, not to speak for him, but he didn't know any better. You know, you just try to figure it out as you go along. There's no rule book and you deal with things how you deal with things. And so everyone's kind of doing that. So you're a bunch of little like atoms bouncing off of each other and everyone's trying to figure it out. And you eventually get to you find your space. I was still doing that. I was still grabbing personalities and I was still on that. And I would do impressions. And one time one of my friends is like, damn, Gerardo, you have your own personality. You always got to do impressions. And it hit me. And he was just busting my chops. But I was like, wow. And it really hit deep because I was like, I saw what I was doing. And it really made me realize what was happening. So that was an epiphany for me in my life.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, because I think that's also a common strategy that we use, because I think it's, you know, so many of us are people pleasers. We don't want to disappoint and we want to fit in and we're desperate to fit in. And part of that's just survival. And I remember doing the same thing, that I would adapt my personality to fit who I was with.
Right.
And because I didn't want to not fit in. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be liked, all that stuff back in, you know, high school or college. And I had to learn that's not really the best way to go. Like, it's far better to know what your values are and act according to values, because there's a number of benefits, one of them being higher self-confidence, but also they give you these guardrails for your behaviors.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, sorry, I interrupted. So
no,
you're in the Marines, point. You're acting, you kind of have the social chameleon thing going on. Someone slaps you over the head with a comment.
Right. And they just, so, and that was towards the end. I was in for 5 years and that was towards the end. And a lot of other stuff had gone through that time. You know, I was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and saw what I saw and did what I did. And that was, it was a different experience for me. But on this journey, so I get out of the Marine Corps. When I'm getting out, I was about 6 months from getting out of the Marine Corps. I was in North Carolina and I met the person who is the love of my life. And she was a nutty kid. She just turned 21 and I was, I think, 22, maybe 23 at the time. And it just, you know, we just really hit it off. And my first real like love relationship in my life. And I get out of the Marine Corps. We move back to California. And now it's like, so I hit another point in my life of, okay, so what do you do? Well, what does a man do? You get a job, you go to work, you make money, you work, you make money, you work, you make money, you get married. Okay, let's get married. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't have anyone to really look to. I didn't have a model. I didn't have a mentor. And so I just full in on that model. I'm going to work my ass off. I'm going to get up early. I'm just going to do what I got to do. And the relationship started to suffer.
Yeah. And, provide for the family.
Right.
And our relationship suffer.
Right. And it was like, why is she upset that I'm not lovey and huggy and there for all the time? I'm making money. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
I'm showing my love for her.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and then she had her thing going on in life and she had her growth as well. And we ended up getting divorced and splitting up and getting divorced. Well, hello emotions. I was
a big puddle. That does crack you open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was
nothing like a divorce to crack you open.
A big puddle of snot and tears, you know, it was like, wow.
It's funny if I can jump in there, Jason, because I've seen a lot of men over 20 plus years. And one of the biggest motivators for them to come in to see me is a romantic partner saying, if you don't go get help, I'm leaving you. Either that or they've actually left.
Right.
And that's what often will wake us up to, oh shit, something's wrong.
Right.
Like the skills that I learned growing up they're not working for me in relationship.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what it was that, you know, and I think typical of a Gen X, you know, I was born in 71 and divorced parents. I never knew parents in the same house. I was, I think, two of my parents divorced. My mom never got remarried. My stepmom has been in my life pretty much my whole life, you know, but that was my stepmom and my dad, and that was a different situation and whatever. But so, yeah, so I didn't have a real picture of that Main Street family and stuff of that nature. I don't think a lot of people do. But so yeah, to your point, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, right? That's what everyone says. I'm looking around for help and it's like, I don't know. I don't know. What do you do? This is another reason why I really had to up my game and get into helping people, was not just helping folks on the side, but really because there is so much need for mental health and for support. And mm-hmm. As we go through this world, you know, we only get so much. Our user's manual, it's like, you remember the show Greatest American Hero?
Oh, like yeah. You're going way back.
He aliens come down and give him this magic suit and these powers, but he loses the instruction manual. So he doesn't know how to fly. And he's learning
that show.
Yeah. And he's learning how he goes along. And he's like, he finds out he can turn invisible in one episode. And because he lost the instruction manual, well, that's like, I think that's how we show up on this earth. We mm-hmm. come to this earth with everything we need. We have all the spirit and source, God, whatever you want to call it, gives us everything. And somehow we lose that. And we have to relearn it.
So let me ask you this. Do you have a way to tap into source now?
For me? My personal? Yeah, I meditate. I'm very mindful. I'm into nature. I'm very spiritual. And so that's my practice. I meditated before the show today. I do every Monday through Friday when I'm in the office. I definitely meditate. You know, on weekends, it's how our morning starts. But and just being more aware of it. I think that's kind of a theme for me, is awareness and just acknowledging it. And nature's really big for me.
May I thank you for sharing that. May I share a story with you?
Please, please, I'd love to hear it.
Because this happened recently and I was kind of taken aback by it. But so I was seeing my therapist, who's a former monk, French guy, older guy in Kensington. And he was talking to me about kind of, you know, a number of different things, actually. And we had touched on the subject of source. And as he was talking, we did a short little meditation. But I saw myself going down these really old ancient stairs that were kind of moss and water covered into a little antechamber. There's like a meditation cushion in front of this doorway, which was decorated with a mandala. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'm supposed to sit on the cushion and just, you know, breathe and meditate,
right?
Which I did. And as I brought my physiology down and relaxed myself and got centered, the mandala doorway started to roll open. And behind the door was what looked like water. Mm-hmm. That's the best way I can describe it. Light, really light water. But it didn't come spilling through the doorway. It was just completely filling up this pathway behind the door. Mm-hmm. So I get up and I kind of walk over to it. And I reach my hand into it. And as I reach my hand into it, my hand dissolved into bubbles or molecules. And I thought, oh, wow, this is source. Wow. And I stepped into it completely, and my whole body dissolved into bubbles or molecules and just became one with source. And I was filled up with this relaxation, this peace, this fulfillment. And I was like, holy shit, like I've never had this experience before. Like it was palpable, it was visceral, it was full body. And I was just like, huh. So now I continue to try and get back to that with that visual. And I really enjoy it. But yeah, I think, you know, nature's high up there, meditation high up there, deep breathing. But I do think that, you know, the more people we can get connected to source or get connected to, you know, some of these spiritual beliefs, like all is one, right. Honor one another, respect one another, the better off this world's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, there's love is connection, peace is connection, yeah. You know, and all else is not.
Acceptance.
Yeah. You know, that sounds very similar to shamanic journeying, what you were just talking about. The South American, for sure, South American indigenous people, their shamanic journeying is very similar to that, where you go down a path and they walk you through, and you go down a river and you go into the earth and you go down, kind of similar to that. So it's amazing. What mine is, and since you shared, I'll share with mine, yeah, is please. That there's a structural way that does it. But what I normally do is I'll meditate and I'll go out into the universe and I'll just go beyond, and I just keep floating, and I go off of Earth and into the, you know, galaxies and universe, and just go, and then I see everything becomes just light, and I'm part of that.
That's
light.
Cool. I like that. Yeah.
And then it all becomes one, you know. And we obviously don't have time today to go into all of it, but there's a technique where you do that, where you meditate in your room, then you meditate, you see yourself in that room above the house, and then you see above the city, and then you see yourself above the state, and then you see yourself above the country, and then you just keep removing yourself. And then you also then return. It's kind of a long process, and you return back to yourself, but you end up going out into the universe. It's kind of like inductive.
Well, and it's funny to me because it sounds like, you know, I'm a comic book geek, and it sounds like Doctor Strange's kind of astral projection, which always amazes me how there's some truth in many of these fictional stories that we love.
Right.
Like Avatar, The Last Airbender, that's got a lot of truth in it, and it's a cartoon.
Right.
Yeah. So let's bring it back to NLP. And what advice would you give to people that are struggling with things from their past that might be holding them back?
Yeah. One thing I just want to, I want to close a loop real quick. So
okay, please.
We ended up getting divorced, ended up being apart 7 years. She got remarried. We stayed in touch. We're always good friends. She's the love of my life. Always has been. We ended up getting back together, and we've been together this time for 17 years now.
Wow. Congratulations.
Cause she was the one. And I just mentioned that because, you know, that it just kind of, it closes that loop where
it does close, you know, the story.
It,
well, yeah,
it was a situation where I found my mind.
Now, let me ask you this, because, and her learning kind of aside, we'll just put that separate.
Yeah.
Did you have to do some learning in order to show up differently in relationship the second time around, to show up successfully?
Completely. Yeah, I had to get a lot of what I'll call life out of the way. I had been so reserved. I had been so doing what everyone told me to do. I'd been so like, oh, well, this is what I'm supposed to do. I lived in that supposed to do for so long. I had to live for me. And it was really about my journey.
You know, like relationship skills or communication or emotional awareness.
Yeah, definitely emotional awareness. Because when that opened up, I had to acknowledge all that and acknowledge your emotions are good. Your emotions are positive. Their emotions are trying to tell you something. You mm-hmm. know, that's something I work with clients with. It's like, don't push the emotions away. And that's something I definitely want to talk about that to answer your other question. But yeah. So I did have a long journey to go, and I had a lot of growing up to do, and also a lot of growing into me and being Jason.
Yeah. Well put.
Yeah.
Being comfortable in your own skin. So yeah, let's go back to that idea of emotions as messengers. Cause that's a big one, and not, we don't have to run away from our emotions. We don't have to suppress them. We don't have to hold them at arm's length. So how does that tie into people that are stuck with incidents from their past?
So I want to share a couple quotes. The first one's from Freud. Unexpressed emotions will never die. They are buried alive and will come forth later in uglier ways.
Yeah, but Freud liked to have cocaine blown up his ass. So how credible a source is he?
I'm not worried about the source so much as the words.
Okay, maybe it's a good quote.
You know, the broken clock's right twice a day, right?
I was like, that story about Freud. I was like, oh, yeah, what does that feel like, huh?
Yeah, and then someone was saying that, so Freud was his own thing, and
yeah,
that's a whole other thing. Milton Erickson also said, patients are patients because they're out of rapport with their unconscious mind. Mm. And so once again, awareness, you know, to your point, ask yourself, where is this coming from? This emotion, you know, what is it that I'm not hearing? And emotions are messengers. And so the one thing, Stephen Gilligan, someone that I've learned from, him and Robert Diltz together, they talk about generative coaching. And they say that when you have these emotions, you just say, welcome. Welcome. You're part of me. You're here for a reason. What are you here to tell me? And you welcome them in. And you get the message, and you don't have to react to it. You don't have to respond to it. It's just
feel shame about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally.
But you know, one of the things I've noticed, Jason, is that I think prior to that, we have to develop self-awareness, right? Because the vast majority of us are really poor in self-awareness. So we're not even aware what we're thinking or what we're feeling to a large extent.
And, right. And that's what I was saying about for how NLP helped me on my journey, is it brought my awareness, and it really allowed me to look at, oh, I do have strategies, and I'm doing this on quote unquote on purpose. And I'm doing this for my values. I'm doing this for a reason, because I think that this is the most important thing about this world. So relationships, my value in relationships was probably like security. And that's a tough high value to have in relationships. You know, there's not a lot of love and a lot of emotional feeling in there. So yeah. So having that awareness, bringing that to the forefront, that's the first thing I do is with clients, is I talk to them about their unconscious mind, make them aware of it. And then we start talking about these other things. And just like to your point, the word awareness, this is what it is. This is what's going on. And I think that alleviates some of that burden. Some of that, you mentioned shame sometimes, mm-hmm. because, well, why am I doing this? And why do I act this way? It's like, it's just something that's going on. It's something you can change.
Yeah. I like that line from mindfulness of allow whatever's arising to arise without judgment. And right. that without judgment phrase, we really struggle with, especially men, because, you know, we're socialized to be stoic, to not feel, and yet we're human. So we do feel. Right. And when those two come into conflict, which they inevitably will, I think we feel embarrassment, shame, guilt potentially. But the biggest one is shame, which, you know, shame to me is the belief that we are unworthy of connection, love, and belonging. And right. what are we seeing out in the real world right now? But an epidemic of male loneliness, male drug abuse and addiction, and deaths of despair. That's all disconnection to me.
Yeah.
And you know, to go back on that, you know, we were talking about kind of emotions as messengers. The other part of it on the other end is when we get the message, we have to interpret the message correctly. For example, I see a lot of people that are dealing with anxiety and think that anxiety means don't move forward with this. It means right. turn around and go away. And I don't think that's correct. I think that usually the indicator with anxiety is it's signaling that you're going in the right direction. It's uncomfortable, and you need to go through this fear rather than turn away from it.
Right. And that goes back to what I was talking about earlier, that, and we deal with talking about neurolinguistics again, is that these filters. So a quick story, two kids, 8 and 10 years old, making mud pies. The mom's like, listen, I got to work. I'm going to be in my room. You boys are on your own. You could babysit yourselves. You're going to be fine. It's summertime. They're off from school. They decide, you know what we need to do? Let's make some mud pies. But they're like, I don't want to be outside. You know what? Let's make them on the kitchen table. So 8 and 10 years old, what are they going to do, right? They get these buckets to go outside, make some mud, bring it in. They're making mud pies on the table. Mom comes out and freaks out, completely freaks out. What are you doing? Oh my God, I can't believe it, whatever. They got to clean it up. They got to do their stuff. The one child takes away from this event, I'm a bad kid. I don't do what I'm told. I'm a bad person. I don't know. I do bad things. Why am I doing this? The other one takes away, don't make mud pies on the kitchen table. Same experience, same parent, total different things they took away from it.
Yeah.
And that's
overgeneralization.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a huge mistake that we make. Yeah. Yeah. Good story. Yeah. So I got to wrap up here shortly. Yep. And in wrapping up, is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
You know, the one thing that we talked about or that we were thinking about is the helpful mindset. Mm-hmm. Mindset is such an important thing. You know, it's how you address things, how you face things. You know, like you talked about what things mean to you. The one that I love, the one that I talk about the most with people is the beginner's mind. The Shoshin, the Zen Buddhism, you know, it's an attitude of openness, eagerness, lack of preconceptions. And the way I break it down is really be curious and flexible in your thinking. You know, if you're open to that, you don't know everything, and that when you hear new things, being flexible and maybe absorbing that and seeing that things aren't always the way you think they are, that's a great place to start.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I tell clients to be curious and non-judgmental.
Yeah.
And same idea. And I remember I had a philosophy professor back at Pomona College who was brilliant. And one time in class, and this was before I was even into psychology, he said, you know, psychology is about helping you realize when you do this. And he made a closed, tight fist. And then he said, and helping you to do this. And he relaxed and opened his hand. And I think that's a good metaphor for psychology, but also for a beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. Where can people get a hold of you if they would like to find out more information about you?
Thank you. Yeah. So my company is One Path Coaching, and my website is onepathcoaching.com, all spelled out, you know, O-N-E. And they could reach out there, and all my social media is on there. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I'm also a writer, so I love to put posts on there. And they could also email me direct at onepathcoaching@gmail.com. Once again, all spelled out @gmail.com.
Fantastic. One Path Coaching. Well, thank you so much, Jason. I really appreciate you coming aboard and spending some time talking. I appreciate the stories and the wisdom. And that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. If you like this episode, please be sure to like, rate, and review, share with your friends. If you didn't like it, you don't have to do a damn thing. Thanks so much. I'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.